So,
oh, thank you.
Wow.
Strength in numbers, at least.
So, Freddie, motivated finding the right contour for tree amplitudes by this rather physical sounding requirement of allowing this contour integral over the Grassmannian to acquire a particle-like interpretation. And it's one of the strangest features about this integral is that the space depends on the space of integration depends on the number of particles, which is not normally the sort of thing we're used to. We're used to the idea of individual particles living on some space, which means, roughly speaking, that the configuration space we should be integrating over is n copies of something, and not where the very space itself depends discretely on the number of particles. So demanding that the integral nonetheless has such an interpretation leads more or less uniquely to the choice of contour that is the one that reproduces the correct tree amplitudes. And I guess Freddie talked about this for NMH tree amplitudes, and this has now been extended for all tree amplitudes as well. So this basic idea, taking this basic idea of a particle interpretation seriously, really is essentially the unique principle that allows you to extract the information about the tree amplitudes from this integral. So there's something seemingly important about this idea of being able to smoothly connect in some way the answers for one n with another n. And of course, we physically know this is correct. It's related to a soft limits. Soft limits are very closely related to space-time locality and so on. So in my part of the lectures, we're going to take this. So Freddie is motivated by adding particles and giving a particle-like interpretation for this whole object. And my lectures are going to try to understand what it means to subtract particles, to hide particles, to start from some object with an incredibly large number of particles, and then just remove them one at a time, just as if you're not looking at them. You're not seeing them. You're just tracing over them. And we'll find that certain canonical, completely canonical operations for removing particles can be done in essentially two different ways. If we apply these canonical operations for removing particles one at a time, nothing interesting happens. We start with a tree amplitude. We end with a tree amplitude. Nothing interesting happens. We don't get any new objects. But pairs of particles, something interesting happens. When you remove pairs of particles, it's of course possible to remove them one at a time. But it's also possible to remove them in a more interesting way. As you'll see, this is these are all just they're very simple operations. What I'm talking about specifically is integrating over particles. And it's possible to integrate them over in a way that's more entangled between the two of them. So that specifically, there's two natural contours of integration that you can choose when you remove a pair of particles. One of them is just two independent ones. The other one entangles the two of them in an interesting way. And we'll find that entangling the two of them leads not to a tree amplitude, but to what look like loop amplitudes. And in fact, we're going to build up all loop amplitudes from precisely these operations. Operations that, had we done them one at a time, would have done nothing interesting, but because we do them in this entangled way, give us loop amplitude. Okay? So that's where we're heading. And by the last day, we'll see how all these things go together to allow us to recursively construct the entire integrand at all loop work. But that's the basic the basic philosophy is that we are hiding things, and we're hiding things in interesting ways, and that's going to give rise to loops. So, but today what I want to do is just spend some time talking about before getting to loops, spend some time talking about some very simple canonical operations that we can do on Yangian invariants. So we see that these this Grassmannian integral is computing all Yangian invariants. And so there's clearly simple relationships between these objects. And in particular, I want to talk about simple ways of taking some invariants and making other invariants out of them. Okay? So just there's basically three very simple sets of operations that you can do, which are guaranteed to map Yangian invariants to the Yangian invariants. So that's a non-trivial statement. They'll map Yangian invariants to Yangian invariants. And putting these operations together in every possible way gives us objects, all of which have physical names. Okay? So putting these operations together in different ways sometimes gives us things that look like cuts of amplitudes. Sometimes they give us leading singularities. Sometimes they give us terms in the BCFW recursion relation. Sometimes they give us the so-called forward limits of amplitudes that are going to be related to loops and so on. So there's lots of ways of putting these basic operations together. I'm not going to describe all of them. I'm going to describe the basic operations. I'm not going to describe all the different zoo of things that you can make. Just to tell you ahead of time, they all have names. They're all interesting. But we're going to talk about the ones that we're going to need today. So the three classes of operations we're going to talk about are, this is not rocket science. One, we're going to learn how to add particles. So in other words, if I hand you some Yangian invariant as a function of z1 up to zn, and here, in most of this discussion, in most of this formal discussion, it doesn't even matter what space we're working with. Are these Zs in twister space, momentum twister space? It doesn't matter. These are all really statements about things that you can get from the Grassmannian integral. Well-defined objects you can get from the Grassmannian integral. It doesn't even matter which space you're working in. Okay? But what we want to do is find a way that if I hand you a Yangian invariant with n particles, to add a particle so you make an n plus one dimensional Yangian invariant in a canonical way. So I want to get from here some y prime. So if this is y of n and some k, I want to get a y prime of n plus one, which depends on z1 up to zn and some zn plus one. Okay? And now you see there's obviously two different kinds of operations that we could talk about when we're adding a particle. We could add a particle and preserve k, or we can add a particle and increase k. Okay? So there's actually two different things here, one for k and one for k plus 1. And that's the first set of things that we're going to talk about. Okay? So we already encountered something like this in momentum space yesterday when we're computing that one BCFW term, where we encountered this notion of an inverse softfactor. Right, that you could take a particle and add it to a lower point object to get a higher point object. Okay? That's exactly what we're going to talk about, except now we're doing it in a manifestly Yangian invariant way. And so we're going to talk about simple operations for adding a particle in a way that preserves k or increases k by 1. These will be the inverse soft factors, in the sense that if you took these things and now took the soft limit of the particles you added, you'd go back to the original object. Okay? So these will be inverse soft factors. Two kinds, k preserving and increasing inverse soft factors. Yes?
So I understand that it doesn't matter whether this is Z is a momentum twister or a twister. But suppose it's a momentum twister.
Yeah.
So I can translate that object over into twister space.
Right.
And I can start my momentum twister object again,
right,
add a particle, and
yes,
then translate that object also over to momentum twister.
Right, right, right.
The difference between these two, just adding a particle in the twister space picture as well.
So something we'll see over and over again is what corresponds to the same physical operation will look like different combinations of these basic maneuvers in twister space and momentum twister space. It's related to the fact you know very well about the difference in the singularity of the support. Okay, so the basic operations just formally are defined anywhere, I'm not going to talk about every single one of them. I'm going to talk about the ones I need, and the ones I need I will typically describe explicitly in momentum twister space, with one notable exception. Okay? But indeed, I mean they will not, the operations will not look simply identical in momentum twister space and in twister space. We'll see one very clear example, because we'll write BCFW in twister space, we'll write BCFW in momentum twister space, and we'll just see what they look like. They'll both be combinations of our operations, but put together in quite different ways. Okay, so next, so this is actually comparatively trivial, as we'll see. It's all simple, but the existence of something like this is reasonably obvious. What's not quite as obvious is that there's a canonical way for removing particles. Perhaps I say it's not so obvious because that we understood for a long time, and this we only understood later. But actually, they don't look very different. They don't look very different in the end of the day. So here, obviously, the idea again is we want to start with some y of z1 up to zn plus 1 and find some way of removing particle zn plus 1 to end up with some y prime. So if I have n plus 1 and k, to go to n and k, or once again, y prime of n and k minus 1 of z1 up to zn. Okay, so we'll describe the operations that do that. You see, you might think this is even more obvious than this one is. Because after all, we're familiar with the fact that amplitudes do nice things in the limit as you remove particles, as you make the particles soft. In the limit as you make particle momenta soft, we know that amplitudes are supposed to have universal behaviors, et cetera. They have a soft factor. They have a well-defined soft limit, stripping off this universal divergent piece. But actually, upon a little more thought, you realize that in fact, that soft behavior is only a property of the full, for example, if we're talking about tree amplitude, it's only a property of the full tree amplitude. Only the full tree amplitude has nice soft limits. If I take individual terms in the BCFW recursion relations, those individual terms do not have well-defined soft limits. Okay? They don't have well-defined soft limits precisely because of the existence of those spurious poles that I mentioned. Okay? And that naively completely obstructs making sense of removing particles. So it turns out that there is nonetheless a way of thinking about removing particles. When this way is applied to the tree amplitude, it of course reproduces the soft limits, as it should, but it gives you a way of mapping a Yangian invariant to another Yangian invariant even when the standard soft limit is not well defined. And what makes it, I think, perhaps the sharper way of saying what's more interesting about this is an operation that takes a lower residue and uniquely gives you a higher residue associated with it. I just add a particle to a lower one to get a higher one. As you'll see, this operation, these operations, depending on how you do them, can take a given higher residue and map it to a number of lower point residues. Okay? So it isn't one-to-one. A given residue upstairs can be mapped to a number of residues downstairs. Okay? That's one-to-one. That's not one-to-one. It's the same thing. So when I say soft limits, here these are the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic soft limits. So these are really the collinear limits that I'm talking about. Okay. So finally, this is the simplest of all. I will talk about a way of taking two Yangian invariants and fusing them into a third one. Okay. So given a y1 of z1 up to zn and a y2 of zm plus 1 up to zn, we'll talk about a way of getting a third one. In fact, we can talk about it now. Okay. That's a third one, just a straight product, but I'll explain why. Okay. So Then we're going to take these basic operations, combine them, and start interpreting what they mean and associate various physical objects with them. Sorry?
Case one is a no. Case one is not a particular case of a book. No. But
when we put them together, hold on. Okay. No, not in the particular way that we're talking about. In fact, let me tell you what they are. Okay, just they're so incredibly easy. We might as well talk about what they are. So first, let's talk about adding particles. So the K preserving, and now I'm going to say this in momentum twister space. Okay. The K preserving inverse soft factor is amazingly simple. Okay. Actually, we already saw it yesterday. Y of Z1 up to Zn and Zn plus 1, Y prime, if I want to add a particle, is just equal to, just algebraically equal to Y of Z1 up to Zn. You just add the label n plus 1. That's it. You don't do anything. It's the same function. You just now say it's a function of the n plus 1 variable. You just add n plus 1. Okay? The K increasing is more interesting. No. Doesn't depend on Zn plus 1. The k-increasing one is y prime. There's no, remember, if I go to momentum space, there's no Fourier transformation. This is momentum twisters, right? So, exactly. So the reason this turns into an inverse soft factor is that even though in momentum twisters I've done nothing, the definition of what the lambda tildes are now depend on this inserted point. So what this does is precisely deform the lambda tildes of n and 1 and not touch any of the lambdas. And that's exactly the inverse soft operation that we defined yesterday. Okay? So that's particularly trivial. All right. So let me put this one. So the k-increasing one turns out to look more interesting. So y of z1 up to zn and zn plus 1, so I'm adding particle n plus 1 here again, y prime, ends up being the following object, n minus 1 n plus 1, 1, 2, multiplied by y for the n particles, but the z1 and the zn are deformed to some z1 hat, then z2, the zn, n minus 1, zn hat. So the picture is, again, I have something here. We'll denote it like this. I'm adding particle n plus 1, an arrow going in, to n, 1, 2, n minus 1, and adding this guy gives me a new object, which is this R invariant. This is that 5 bracket that we defined yesterday. Okay, that 5 bracket, this has some extra k charge, right? It has some fermionic delta function, which is why it's increasing k by 1. It's increasing k by 1. And we're deforming 1 and n, so I'll tell you what the new z1 and zn are. z1 is equal to, z1 hat, is equal to what you would get by taking the line 1, 2 and intersecting it with the plane n plus 1, n minus 1. So this is 1, 2 intersect n minus 1, n plus 1. So that's what it is bosonically. If we were to say it's fully supersymmetrically, this is this is Z1 times 2n plus 1 n n minus 1 minus Z2 times 1n plus 1 n n minus 1. So these are full super objects. Okay? But these are just the bosonic four brackets that I would make out of these objects. Okay? So that's Z1 hat and Zn hat is the other way around. It's what you get from the line n minus 1 n intersecting the plane n plus 1, 1, 2. Okay. Yes.
So the
picture is that exactly what you said. So we're going to be drawing many pictures like this, so it's good to start getting used to them. So we have the plane n plus 1 n, n minus 1. So here's n plus 1, here n, n minus 1. And then we have 1, 2. So here's 1 and 2. The line 1, 2 intersects the plane n plus 1 n, n minus 1 at a point, and that intersection point, that's Z1 hat. Okay, that's the bosonic statement, and it lives to a fully supersymmetric statement as I've written it there. Okay. Okay. Now, so
a supersymmetric part is critical in this entire story. Okay.
No, it's not. No, that's the point. I'm going to describe. Right. If I just wrote this thing down, it is not at all obviously. This is not at all obviously even dual superconformal invariant. Never mind Yangian invariant. Okay. That's the point. I'm going to show that from looking at the Grassmannian that this is obvious. This is the power of the Grassmannian at work. It's a Grassmannian telling us that all these operations are guaranteed to give us Yangian invariants. These are not obvious when you just stare at them. Actually, the first one is obvious, but this is not an obvious one. And some of the other ones that we're going to do are not obvious either, but it's staring at the Grassmannian integral that makes them obvious. So I will derive all of these things in a second, but I'm just telling you what they look like. Okay? So these are the operations that this adding a particle preserving K and adding a particle increasing K. Actually, let me just quickly sketch what the nature of the argument is, and then maybe I can fill in some of the details in a second. But the point is, what we actually do is we don't start from a lower thing and we do something to it to make a higher object. What we really do is we start from the one higher point Grassmannian integral, and we identify some particularly simple, easy residues. So there's some particularly simple residues of this Grassmannian integral that you can just find. And we just compute those residues. We know all the residues of these integral are Yangian invariant. And therefore, we compute them, and whatever they are Yangian invariant. We identify them as residues of the one higher point Grassmannian. What are they associated with each one of them? That one is particularly obvious. Okay? So the statement is that if you have n plus 1 particles, okay, and I'm in momentum twister space, there is always some residue of the Grassmannian that has the property that it just puts zeros in the n plus first column. Okay? Huh? No. The other way around. What I'm doing is precisely identifying what these inverse soft factor operations are. You see, the statement is that there's something you can do at a lower particle amplitude to make a higher point Yangian invariant. To prove it, what I'm going to do is actually start from the higher point Grassmannian integral and find a residue. I'm going to find some particularly simple residues of that higher point Grassmannian integral that are clearly computed by the lower point object. Okay? So the statement is that there are D matrices where these elements are all generic, But residues are chosen such that the n plus first column is all set to zero. Okay? It's possible to set all those elements to zero. That residue, this turns out to be a residue of the, this turns out to be a residue of the n plus 1 k Grassmannian, and the value of that residue is, well, quite obviously equal to this. Okay? Because it's exactly the same integral. There's no dependence on dn plus 1. So the only non-trivial thing I have to do is to prove that there is actually a residue of the n plus 1 k Grassmannian that has that form. Because that turns out to be very simple, but let's defer it for a second. I just want to give you the structure of the argument. What about this guy? This guy looks more interesting. So the point is that there is always a residue of the of a higher point Grassmannian now with one higher k. Okay, so I start with k plus 1 and n plus 1. So this is k, and there's one more column, which I'll put at the top, and there's one extra particle. Here's particle n plus 1 is here. Okay. So the claim is that there's always a residue of the n plus 1, k plus 1 Grassmannian integral, which has the form one, two, three, four, five, where these guys are non-zero in this column. Everything else is zero. The rest of this column is zero. And these guys are generic. Okay? Now, this perhaps looks a little peculiar, but remember that the second that there's five non-zero guys upstairs, I can use the bosonic delta function associated with that row to solve for all of them. I can use the GL1 to put that one to 1, let's say, and I can just solve for all of them. So that allows me to canonically solve for all of these guys upstairs. And then what I then I have to show that there is such a residue, and when you compute that residue, you find exactly that formula. Okay? So it's a particular residue of the n plus 1, k plus 1 Grassmannian, which is given by that formula. Yeah.
One integral.
Exactly. That's right. So if you like, in
doing the full residue, there's just a completely canonical way of doing part of it, and then, well, whatever you do the rest. But the rest would be computed in the lower Grassmannian, and that's how you get that formula. Right. It's several. That's right. But you're doing a collection of them to put it to this point. Right.
Like the big Grassmannian that is the shoot cycle itself is the smaller Grassmannian.
That's right.
What do you think? Does it help? Do you
know
what shoot cycles are?
No.
It won't. But let me. In case it looks a little funny that there's five guys there. So one reason I said
it's obvious that there's five guys is, well, If the row is going to contain any number of things, it shouldn't contain 4 or 3 or 2, because then you can't solve for anything upstairs. Then you're constraining the external momentum twisters, which you don't want to do. So 5 is perfect for being able to canonically solve for everybody. But on top of that, if you just think for a second, remember we just said that adding this guy corresponded back in momentum space to deforming the lambda tilde for the two adjacent particles, deforming lambda tilde n and deforming lambda tilde 1 and leaving all the lambdas invariant. That was one of the inverse soft factors you might want to talk about in momentum space. The other inverse soft factor you might want to talk about would have deformed the lambdas, obviously, okay, the other way around. But if you're going to deform the lambdas of the two adjacent guys, then whatever you're doing back in momentum twister space will be deforming the mu tildes also of the guys adjacent to them. So that takes you one more out, and now you have five guys. So whatever you're doing has got to involve five momentum twisters. Okay? And this is what it ends up being. So I can go through, we'll go through the derivation, but I just wanted to see how it works. The logic is that we identify particularly simple residues in the higher Grassmannian, which are clearly computed in a simple way related to the lower one. Okay. So that's adding particles. Next, let's talk about removing particles. Let me just tell you what the operations are. Okay? So these look really incredibly simple. If you want to remove a particle and reduce K, So Zn, and I want to start from something that has n plus 1 particles, what's the dumbest thing you would do to remove that particle? Just integrate over it, okay? Now this guy is, I'm always going to write d3/4 because this is an integral over CP3. You can always think of it as a d4/4 over vol GL1 if you want, okay? So that's all it is. Okay. So this is the, this is a K decreasing operation. All right? And notice something. I haven't told you what contour of integration that I'm choosing there. Okay? In fact, the sharp statement is that Y prime is, it's a Yangian invariant object. If you apply the Yangian generators for the n plus, for the n particles to that object, you'll find that it turns into a total derivative with respect to n plus 1. Okay? So on any contour of integration on which this integral could possibly be well defined, it's invariant. So that's also interesting because in general, even if you want to do simple residues, simple multidimensional residues, why the right-hand side could have many, many different poles. Any one of those residues is going to give you some new invariant. That's what I was telling you. You can start with from one object and end up with many, many different objects. Okay, so this isn't a one-to-one map. Now, what if you wanted to preserve K? If you want to preserve K, we can't. If you want to preserve K, we can't do any integrals. That integral there is knocking down the K by 1 because of the fermionic eta integral. Okay? So if I want to preserve K, there's no integrals that I can do. So what else can I do? What's the only other reasonable thing I can do? I can just identify Zn plus 1 with one of its neighbors, either Zn or with Z1. Okay. Projectively, I can identify it, let's say, with Zn or with Z1. And that also ends up being an operation that's always well-defined, always maps Yangian invariants to the Yangian invariants. Okay? So this is the integrating out operation. This we call the merge operation for obvious reasons. Okay? And both of them correspond to, both of them physically correspond to what you might think of as soft limits. Okay? There's two ways you can remove particle n plus 1. You can just remove it completely from the definition. That's what integrating out means. It's just gone. You just delete n plus 1, period. Okay? There's no more n plus 1 anywhere. Or by sending Zn towards Zn plus 1 towards Zn, or Zn towards Z1, you're clearly making the momentum of that n plus 1 particle go to 0. So it does correspond to a soft limit in that sense. So, once again, these things are well-defined on any Yangian invariant. When you're talking about something like the tree amplitude with the standard soft limits are well-defined, these operations give you the standard soft limits, but they're a way of talking about these things for any object, whether they have the standard behavior or not. Nope. The thing you get is never singular.
It's not obvious, but it's
true. Take the next permit. Here's a bit of counter. Yes. Take the next permit to be tree amplitude.
Yep.
And do your K increasing.
Yes.
Sure.
In twister space.
No, so here. Right.
Do the operation in twister space.
Right. That's right. So if we. So these things can even be singular, and.
That's perfectly fine. They can have delta function support. Everything is perfectly fine. They can even be singular. When I say they're not singular, when you do in a momentum twister space where everything is should be nice and smooth as a function of the z's, they never are. Of course, in twister space, everything is singular, not just these guys. Every single object is singular. Right. Yeah.
Through zero.
No, I don't think there's any delta zeros. No.
For example, that orange one you stick in front of the y.
No. That's not the formula in what
you told me it's the Yangon operation, which I can do in any of the spaces.
That's right.
I'm not claiming it's the K increasing inverse.
Yes, space. That's
right. I'm just doing this operation in twister space, and the Yangon invariant I choose is the next dimensional tree.
Yeah, I should say.
It's literally the same formula, just that two of them will be vanishing, and the normal twister space support will be singular, and it'll turn that delta function of five variables into one of three. And then it's literally just the, it is singular.
I'm worried that your square bracket matter. Facts and flows.
No. We can go through these, but it's really far. The objects are no more singular than any other object.
Which are all singular in ordinary twister space, of course. Okay. All right. So I haven't proved any of these things yet, but I'm just telling you what they are. And finally, let's talk about the fusing operation. I already told you is just no. I already told you. It's just as trivial as that. If you take y of z1 to zn, zm, y of zm plus 1 up to zn, then the straight product of these things is a new Yangon invariant, thought of as a function of 1 all the way up to n. So this is the fuse operation. Now, we can prove these statements in a variety of ways. Yes?
Lines generate the basis of all possible Yangon invariants, according to your claim, right? Yes. Does this property imply that the product of two Yangon invariants is always a Yangon invariant?
Yes.
It is true?
Yes.
This is a true statement.
Oh, sorry. No. There's something very important here. I should have stressed this. These are distinct sets of z's. So if you take any two guys which share z's in common, it is not true in general.
The Yangon will involve nested sums which know about everything.
Exactly, precisely. But that's the only reason this ends up being invariant. The only reason this ends up being invariant is that these are totally disjoint sets of variables. We'll talk about it in a second when I talk about.
So but this is something that I don't need to care about. This is the property of Yangon.
This
Yangon taking on the function of two this disjoint set of variables always gives a new Yangon.
Exactly. That is a statement. That is a statement. Now, in fact, as we go through the proofs, let me just say that all of these statements can be proven in two ways. Actually, except one of them. One of them really critically needs the Grassmannian integral. At least one of them, we don't know any way of proving without looking at the Grassmannian integral. But almost all of them are much aided by working with the integral.
Because you're manifestly playing with invariants and everything is fine. But we can prove them either by just directly staring at the Yangon generators and acting on these objects and see what they do, or by explicitly identifying them as Grassmannian residues. So we can prove all of these things in both ways. With one exception, this merge operation, we don't know how to prove directly by playing with the Yangon generators, at least totally obviously, but as a consequence of playing with the Grassmannian integral. Perhaps there's a simple proof of it, and it just escaped our attention. We didn't try very, very hard. So, for instance, let's do the ones that are sort of totally obvious. Let's do the ones that are totally obvious, just playing with Yangon generators. And then for those, I won't give you the direct proof with the Grassmannian integral. Okay? So let's look at this one. This is an utterly obvious statement. Okay? Because when I say that this is invariant under the n plus 1 Yangon generators, first of all, everything is obvious at the level of the level 0 generators. Everything is obvious just for ordinary conformal invariants, superconformal invariants. We have the level 1 generators. The level 1 generators involve this nested sum of the commutator zi, ddzi, zj, ddzj. We've got to talk about things schematically that look like the sum over I less than j, like that. But of course here everything is totally obvious. Nothing depends on n plus 1. Nothing depends on n plus 1, so this is just obviously annihilated if that's annihilated.
Oh, jeez. Yes, ready. So sorry. How could I do that? Thank you. Okay. All right, so this trivially annihilates the persona. Okay, let's do another one, which is obvious. This one is obvious at the level just of Yang-Yang generator.
Once again, it's obviously invariant under the level zero generators. It's obviously a superconformal invariant quantity. Okay? What about the level one generators? The level one generators are a little more interesting. So let's write each term like this, just so I write it. Let me write each one of those terms in the form, you know, 1, 2 plus 1, 3, plus up to 1n, plus 1n plus 1. So the Yang-Yang generators acting on n plus 1 particles would be the sum of the terms of that form. Okay. Then we finally have n minus 1n, n minus 1, n plus 1, and n plus 1. Okay. So the sum of these generators annihilate this object, up to n plus 1. Okay? Yes, that's right. Each one of those ij's is one of these commutators that occurs in the definition of the level 1 generators. Okay? So, now, this sucker annihilates the integrand. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in looking at the Yang-Yang generators for the n particles acting on the integral. Okay? So we're interested in acting these guys on the integral. Okay? Okay, that's fine. Those guys on the integral give me what? Those guys on the integral give me the sum of those guys. Negative the sum of those guys on the integral. Well, the sum of those guys on the integral is equal to zero because this is invariant under the level one generators. It's just n plus 1 times the sum of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, which is all the level 1 generators. So this annihilates the integrand. Okay? That's right. The level 0 generators, because the level 0 generators, the n plus 1 level 0 generators annihilate it, it annihilates it. And notice that the level 0 generators annihilate this thing up to a total derivative. That's how it obviously annihilates. So these things are annihilated up to a total ddz n plus 1 derivative. So on any contour, which is naively well-defined, you would get an invariant. It's an invariant form. Okay? Yang invariant form. Okay? Let's do another example of something which is obvious. The fusion of two of them is totally obvious. And as I said, in all these examples, you can have fun going and proving that it's true from the Grassmannian integral by just doing little trivial exercises with determinants. Okay? Just trivial little exercises with determinants, mapping minors to minors, and showing that all of these things are true. But I want to just go through the ones that are obviously true from at the level of the generators. The final one is the fusion. Okay? This is particularly obvious. Once again, the level zero generators are obvious. The level one generators are not totally obvious because there's the commutator of the two terms. But what are the dangerous terms? There are the pieces in the commutator where the two terms are both in here. Those annihilate it. There's the pieces with the two terms in here. Those annihilate it. There's the piece where one term is here and the other one's there, but that's killed because the level zero generators that annihilate the subject. Okay? So this is also in there. And again, you can have fun proving it from the Grassmannian integral by showing that there's always some residue of the Grassmannian which is block diagonal. Okay. Block diagonal with a little, with an N1 by K1, N2 by K2 block rectangular form, which is what this means. Okay? All right? So let me finally prove. Let me finally prove the statements that are not completely obvious just by playing with generators. So let's look at this merge operation. Okay? Actually, maybe I should do that. Maybe I should do that one first. Let me do the adding one particle first. Let's just do let's do a simple example. So, how much detail do I want to do this in? Yeah, let's do a simple example. Let's write it like this: 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to be adding the particle 8. I'm going to be imagining that 8 is the inverse soft factor. And I want to now find some residue of this 2 by 8. So this is the problem in G28. I want to find some residue of this Grassmannian that's computed from the one lower point object. Okay? Let me just sketch out how this works. So I'm always free to gauge fix. So because I'm interested in relating this to a one lower point Grassmannian, I'm not going to fix the GLK all the way. Okay, I'm going to just fix the GLK to leave a GLK minus one. So I can do that by making one of these guys one and making one of these columns 1, 0, and in this case, putting a zero somewhere else, wherever else I like, in the upper row. In general, I could put k zeros upstairs in the upper row and pick one column to be a k minus one zeros and pick one column to be 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay? That gauge fixes GLK down to GLK minus one. Sorry? Yes, this is the example of just k equals 2, n equals a. Just for fun. Just so you see how it works. I mean, I could do it in generality, but then I'd have indices floating all over the place, which is not very important. So let's. So I'm going to just for convenience gauge fix that component to be zero. Okay? It's obvious why I'm doing it because I'm after seeing something which is going to have all five of these things non-zero. So let's give them a name. Let's give these components a name, T6, T7, T1, T2. Let's give these lower components names. So there would be a T5 here, a T4, U5, U6, U7, U1, U2, U3, U4. Okay? Unobjectionable. Okay, so I'm gauge fixing to this form. And now, again, I just want to find some particular, some natural residues that I can compute. Well, look, this minor 3, 4, so I'm starting off with the integral that has this, all these cyclic minors downstairs, 8, 1, up to 8, 1. But let's start looking at 3, 4. That minor, 3, 4, is linear in T4, right? 3, 4 is U3 times T4. Okay? So I can compute a residue by doing the integral around T4 equals 0 and just setting this minor to 0. Okay? So I'm going to set 3, 4 to 0. And so what do I get? I get 1 over, from doing that, I get 1 over U3. Okay? Because the coefficient is 1 over U3 T4. Actually, I don't have, well, it would take 2 minutes to explain it, but in this gauge fixing, if you do the gauge fixing properly, there's obviously a factor of U3 The whole thing is proportional to U3, so it's actually multiplied by U3 just coming from the gauge fixing. Had I completed the gauge fixing by setting that U3 to 1, then we'd be having a totally normal fine integral. But for a general U3, there is a trivial, quote unquote, Fedayev-Popov factor that's completely trivial to get, but gives you a factor of U3 out front. Okay. Now let's keep going. So now I've set this to 0. Okay. So having set that to 0, I can put that to 0. Now let's look at 4, 5. If I look at 4, 5, 4, 5 is equal to U4 T5. So I did the T4 integral before. I can do the T5 integral to set T5 equal to 0, and I pick up a Jacobian 1 over U4. Sorry, I just pick up a residue 1 over U4. Okay. So what am I left with? I'm left with the U3 times a 1 over, so I just took care of 3, 4, and 4, 5. Okay. Now I should write down 5, 6. So 5, 6 is just... I just set T5 to 0, sorry. So 5, 6 is just U5, T6. Six, seven is T6 U7 minus T7 U6. Seven, eight is just 1 over U7. 8, 1 is 1 over U1. 1, 2 is 1 over T1 U2 minus T2 U1. And 2, 3 is 1 over T2 U3. Okay. Now, this is not at all as bad as it looks. 1 over U4? No, there's no 1 over U. There was a 1 over U4. Yes, I didn't write down the 1 over U4. Thank you. 1 over, right. Then there's a 1 over U3, 1 over U4. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Okay. Now, actually, we're in awesome shape because we now have only 4 non-zero guys upstairs. Okay? So we can solve for all of them. These guys are now completely nailed by the bosonic delta functions of the top row. Okay? That's simply by expanding Z8 is T6, Z6, T7, Z7, T1, Z1, T2, Z2. Just like we did yesterday, we can extract all the coefficients. Okay? So that means in the thing that we have downstairs, so if I write this a little more, if I write this a little more cleanly, I can write this as 1 over T6, T7, T1, T2 times 1 over U1, let me call it capital U2, U3, capital U4, oops, U3, U4, apologize, U5, capital U6, and U7. Where capital U2 is U2 minus T2 over T1, U1, and capital U6 equals U6 minus T6 over T7, U7. See, that's exactly what we want. This top guy, this computed on the upstairs row, just precisely gives me the upstairs R invariant that we talked about. That's exactly the factor that would be 6, 7, 8, 1, 2. That's just what it is. So we can just get rid of that. We can do the T6, 7, 1, 2 integral, and that just would cleanly give us, out in front, a 6, 7, 8, 1, 2 times something. The something which is left looks exactly the same. It looks like the product of a bunch of 1 over u's, except the u's have been shifted a little bit. Okay? This capital U2 and capital U6 has been shifted a little bit relative to how they started off. But if I just redefine this to be capital U2 and redefine this to be capital U6, okay? Sorry, if I just change variables, which I can trivially do, from the little u's to the big u's, then all that changes is in the delta function for the bottom row. Instead of having u1 up to u7 with the same z's, I'll have these new u's multiplied by some shifted z's. So the shift on these u's just translates in the delta function to the shift on the z's. Okay? And if you just do it, you get exactly the formula that I wrote down. So I'll skip that last bit of algebra. So a little bit of magic happened, which here was just slightly, here looked slightly too easy because the bottom guys were one-by-one determinants. But in general what happens is you get these 5 guys upstairs, and this whole process of finding the residues that set all those guys to 0 collapses what you have left to the product of the lower k by k minors instead of k plus 1 by k plus 1 minors. And it does exactly the same shift, okay, precisely the same shift that we talked about to lead to this form. Okay? So that's how you can derive that formula from the Grassmannian. As I said, if someone just handed you that formula and asked, is this formula even superconformal invariant? It's not obvious that it's superconformal invariant. Definitely not obvious that it's Yangian invariant, but it is. And this is how you understand that it is, by explicitly identifying it as a residue of the Grassmannian. Okay, so let's finally talk about the merge operation. I should say that all of these things we're saying abstractly, we have checked on Grassmannian residues up to any large number of n and k you'd like to ask about. Jake could tell you what the last n and k check on these things was, but k equals 5, 27 points, maybe not that high, much higher. Okay, so it's they're all true. They're all, I mean. They're all empirically true statements as well. But anyway, they also have proofs. So let's talk about the merge. Now, so let's do this again. Maybe I can do this one in generality. Let me do this one. Let me do it for a change. I'll do this one in generality. Okay. Sorry?
Related to the particular fact that it comes from Grassmannian, right?
Exactly. Well, you see, the Grassmannian and the Yangian for at least SLM/M are the same thing. You know, they're just synonymous. If this is the thing that produces all invariants, they're just synonymous. So you can say Yangian, you can say Grassmannian, say whatever you like. We of course find it more. We like playing with the integral because it's instead of screwing around with the algebra, you just are actually playing with the actual objects. Okay, and of course it tells you more things. It tells you about relationships between objects. It tells you a lot of other things too. But as we just saw, 3 of the things we just very easily saw just at the level of generators is true, and then similar little exercises with determinants show that it's true at the level of the Grassmannian integral. This is the sort of thing, some of these things are harder to see. I mean,
it's probably true that if you take this object that I gave you and then you just hit it with the generators, of course it's true that you'll be able to verify that it annihilates it. But, right, huh? What's the problem with this one? The problem with this one is when you hit it, when you hit it with the level one generators, you find that it would vanish if it was true. Let me just, it's obvious, but let me tell you. You would find that it's true if ddzn of y, let's say you're taking zn plus 1 to zn, of y z1 up to zn, zn plus 1, at zn plus 1 equals zn, you would find that it's true if this is equal to ddzn plus 1 of y at z1 up to zn and zn plus 1 at zn equals zn plus 1. Okay? Exactly. What, when you act, you find it's equal to 0 plus this minus that. Exactly. It's really with zn plus 1 this minus zn that. Okay? But because zn is going to zn plus 1, these two things become equal to each other, and so it looks like it's proportional to this minus that. It looks like it's not 0. It's not obviously 0. Okay? It would be 0 if somehow, miraculously, when you took zn to zn plus 1, the derivatives also became proportional to each other. That's not totally obvious at the level of the generators. It's true. It is a true property of Yangian invariants. And it's something we'd see from the Grassmannian integral.
Invariants in general.
Well, because all the Yangian invariants are computed by the Grassmannian integral, then it's true.
But I thought the last statement was conjecture somehow.
Well, okay. At that level, at exactly that level. Okay, this is at physicist level. I think it's definitely a physicist proof. So
at level of physicist proof, it's true. It is not obvious. So that's all I'm saying. It's not obvious purely at the level of generators, but it's a true statement nonetheless. Huh? Here there's no holomorphic anomaly, none of this business. Everything is nice and complex. Note that with these, we can talk later about what the role of the holomorphic anomaly is. But in this story, there's no Z bars anywhere in momentum twister space. It's all Zs. Everything is nice and holomorphic. There's no issues with holomorphic anomaly. Okay. But I want to stress that these things, when you do this merge operation, you don't get things that are 0 over 0 and they're very delicate. You get nice finite things or 0. You can get 0, okay? But they're not delicate 0 over 0 objects, okay? They're very nice, robust quantities. Okay. But as I said, this is the one thing that just playing with generators isn't obvious. So let me give you the quick proof that it's true. So what happens if you take Zn plus 1 to Zn, then inside the bosonic delta, inside the delta function, so we have a delta 4-4 of d alpha 1 Z1 plus d alpha n minus 1 Zn minus 1 plus d alpha n plus d alpha n plus 1 Zn now, because I made Zn plus 1 equal to Zn. Okay? So clearly, I should redefine this guy to be a new... So let's say in the original variables, just for fun, I decided to put hats on these last two guys. So let me redefine this one to be D... Let me redefine this to be D alpha n. Okay? Now that I've redefined this to be d alpha n inside the bosonic delta functions, inside the whole delta functions, the minors that sit out in front, 1, 2 up to k, to n, 1 up to k minus 1, now some of these minors are going to be affected. Actually, exactly one of these minors is affected. Okay? In other words, the d's that appear here now, wherever I had, now I should now I can replace I still have the same number of variables, but I'm going to have d hat alpha n plus 1, and everywhere I had d alpha n, I'm going to write it as this d alpha n minus d alpha hat n plus 1. Okay? So all the minors are unaffected except for one of them. The one minor which is all altered, it is the one that ends in dn. Okay? So the one that would start with dn minus k plus 1 all the way up to dn. This minor that I had beforehand, if you like, it would have had a hat on it beforehand, is now altered to just this guy, n minus 1 plus k up to dn minus dn minus 1 plus k up to d n plus 1. Okay. So the notation here is that just think of each one of these as a column vector. I'm taking the epsilon together of these column vectors, and I just, in doing this change of variable, this now becomes that. Okay. This is the only minor that's affected because everywhere else n is accompanied by n plus 1, or n doesn't appear. And since n is accompanied by n plus 1, in this shift, that minor is unaffected, because everything is epsilon together. Okay. So that means that I have this new vector, dn plus 1, this new k vector, this is some k vector, this k vector is going to make an appearance in k plus 1 denominators. Okay? Let's just write it out very explicitly which denominators it's going to make an appearance in. Okay, there's a denominator that we just wrote down, which is dn minus k plus 1 up to dn minus dn minus k plus 1 up to dn plus 1. So let me underline it when it appears. Okay, so it's appearing there. Let me call this factor 1 over p k plus 1. It's a linear polynomial in D. Okay. There's going to be k plus 1 places that they appear, so I'm just labeling them. I'm just labeling this guy 1 over pk plus 1. Then it's going to appear, well, everywhere else, n plus 1 was making an appearance before in this product of minors. Sorry. This did used to go up to n plus 1 before. Okay, n plus 1. Okay. So there's this guy, dn minus k plus 2 up to dn, dn. N plus 1, there it is. So let's call this 1 over P1. Okay. Finally, all the way up to when it appears at the start, the last term that we had, Dn plus 1, D1 to Dk minus 1. Let's call this factor 1 over Pk. Okay. So this new integration, the variable dn plus 1, there's k variables, occurs in k plus 1 linear factors. Okay? Now, any way I want to do a contour integral on this whole object, in any way I want to do a contour integral, I have to choose some contour for these guys. Okay? So there's k plus 1 poles, and I have to choose k of them to define the contour. Just to do the integral over dn plus 1. Now, you might think that the answer you get would depend on which contour you chose, right? And in total generality, it would be true, except there's something very special here. We have k plus 1 linear factors. Sorry. We have a function of k variables, kds, and there's k plus 1 factors. Okay? So the global residue theorem tells you that all of the residues are equal to each other or zero, up, up the sign, they're all equal to each other. Okay? Think about what the global residue theorem would say. The global residue theorem is a whole sequence of two-term identities. Okay? A global residue theorem, I have k plus one factors, so it's a k-dimensional integral, so let me choose my k polynomials to be, let's say, pk plus one, to be let's choose pk, pk plus 1 to be one of the polynomials and all of the rest of them singly to be the other ones. So the global residue theorem tells me that any pair of residues is are equal and opposite to each other. Okay? So all the residues are equal. Up the sign, all the residues are equal to each other. It doesn't matter which residue you pick. That's very nice because it's a particularly simple residue to choose. The particularly simple residue to choose is the one that puts P1 and up to PK equal to 0. Putting P1 up to PK equal to 0 is nothing other than setting this K vector, dn plus 1, to equal 0. Okay? And if you set that K vector, dn plus 1, to 0, everything collapses and you just get precisely the product of the cyclic minors of the lower point Gross minor. So this little final argument was crucial, that it was a contour integral with k plus one factors and k variables, so it didn't matter. There are many residues you could in principle choose, but they all give you the same answer. This is what obstructs. So this works if you match Zn to Zn plus one. It maps if we work Zn to Z1. But let's say you try to merge Zn with Z2. If you try to skip one, what you find happens is that you start affecting more minors. And so this guy starts occurring in more polynomials. You have more than k plus 1 factors. You have k plus 2, k plus 3, more polynomials involving this single k vector. Now it's no longer true that the global residue theorem guarantees that they're all equal to each other. And now one of them is always OK. The one where you set all of these, the one where you said these to 0, that's always a residue. That's OK, but there are other residues for which it's simply not true. Okay. So, but in this very special case where you merge with its neighbors, it is a true statement.
The dual superconformal or
of course, but it's not so. It's not fully Yang invariant.
That's right.
All right. Okay. So that is. So I finished. Describing and proving the invariance that these objects map invariance to invariance.
So now let's start using it. Yeah, it's somewhat surprising that these very, very simple operations combined together, start generating lots and lots of interesting things, lots and lots of interesting physical objects, which are all then guaranteed to be Yangon invariant. And allows you to prove some surprisingly powerful statements. For example, let's immediately prove the original Grassmannian conjecture, that all leading singularities are contained as residues of the Grassmannian integral. So now we can prove this statement easily. Okay. So let's put these let's just combine these operations in some very, very simple, obvious ways. So yes.
Function of the momenta, which is conformal and dual conformal at the same time, just a bosonic form.
Conformal? No. I mean, purely conformal? No. I mean, you mean without stripping off factors?
Yes.
You always have to strip off factors. No, not that I know. No. There's always some MHV.
It's very important that there is this MHV prefactor helping.
Yes, absolutely.
If you would strip off that, then it would be harder to make statements.
Yes, absolutely. But that's related to how this tilting works in the set of all these Yang-Yang generator. So the fact that you've got to strip something off looks very natural in that, from that picture. People tell me. I haven't looked myself. Okay. So let's begin with by showing that leading singularities are Yang-Yang invariant. So let's start, and this is the only place today that I'll stay in Twister space. Let's start in Twister's. Let's play in Twister space, and imagine just for a second that we have some invariant here y1, some invariant y2, and that all the particles are destroyed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, they're all destroyed. So this is the Yang-Yang invariant. The fusion is the Yang-Yang invariant. The product is the Yang-Yang invariant. Now let's merge 4 and 5. Let's merge them and call them both, say, W internal. That's the Yang-Yang invariant. This is the new Yang-Yang invariant. Now let's eliminate, get rid of, this new label WI by integrating over it. That's the Yang-Yang invariant. I could clearly keep going. Okay, I mean I can do this. I can merge it. In fact, we'll sometimes use this notation to denote that we merge the particles and then we integrate them out. Okay, so this is some Yang-Yang invariant. Okay, I mean, so this is, it's obviously, you can do anything we like. These things are all Yang-Yang invariant objects. Okay. The sequence of fuse, merge, and integrate out. Okay, so this is a nice set of Yang-Yang invariants. As I said, every one of these things has a nice physical interpretation, and these are leading singularities.
Okay, as Lionel and Dave and Jared Kaplan very nicely pointed out in the fall, these pictures, the pictures where you just I mentioned this in one of the earlier lectures. If you just draw pictures in Twister space as if they're loop diagrams, and you integrated out the internal lines in Twister space, that corresponds in momentum space to computing a leading singularity. Let's just see it explicitly for a simple case. Just putting two of these guys together. Okay. You'll see what's special about closing it into a square, but let's just start off putting two of them together. Okay? So let's take the formula where I have integral d3/4 W internal, then I have M left. So M left of, and I don't care about dependence on the external, on the other particles, just its dependence on W internal, M right, or let's call it M1 and M2, 1 and M2 of W internal. Okay? So what I mean by this is an integral d squared mu tilde, d squared lambda tilde, d4 eta tilde over GL1, 1 over vol GL1. Okay, so there's an overall GL1 that acts on mu tilde, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Okay? So I have a 1 over vol GL1. Then I have M, right, just this. So M1 of mu tilde, lambda tilde, M2 of mu tilde, lambda tilde. Now, let me write each one of these M1s and M2s from where they came from the Fourier transforms back from momentum space. So there's a d squared mu tilde, d squared lambda tilde, d4 eta tilde over vol GL1. (Clears and I have integral d squared lambda e to the I mu tilde lambda m1 of lambda lambda tilde. Oh, sorry, an eta tilde here. Lambda lambda tilde and eta tilde. And then I have a d squared lambda prime e to the I, the same mu tilde lambda prime m2 of lambda prime lambda tilde eta tilde. Okay? So this is all trivial Fourier transform exercises. Now let's do the integral d squared mu tilde. There's a 1 over vol GL1 on the whole thing, but I can imagine the 1 over vol GL1 is being done on the d squared lambda tilde part if I like. And just do the d squared mu tilde integral as a straight d squared mu integral. Okay? I'm just doing a straight d squared mu integral. That turns this into a delta function that says that lambda is equal to negative lambda prime. Negative lambda prime. Right? So what I'm left with is an integral d squared lambda tilde d squared lambda d4 eta tilde over vol GL1 m1 of lambda lambda tilde eta tilde m2 of negative lambda lambda tilde eta tilde. Okay? Now, this is nothing other than the integral over the Lorentz invariant phase space of this internal particle. This d squared lambda tilde d squared lambda over vol GL1 precisely is otherwise known as d4p delta of p squared, if you want it to be old-fashioned about it. Okay? That's exactly what it is. In fact, the 1 over vol GL1 is perfectly there to make it a three-dimensional integral, okay? Which is what the d4p delta of p squared is. That's exactly the on-shell phase space integral. That's the integral over the internal particle. And so this is giving me m1 of some momentum p and eta tilde, and m2 precisely of negative p and eta tilde. It's exactly, precisely, doing the integral over p. Each one of these is an object with its own, you know, all the momentum delta functions and everything are in each one of these extra objects. And it's integrating of this intermediate particle with a delta of p squared. Okay? So that's how you see that simple picture in Twister space, the beautiful simple picture in Twister space, is exactly computing a cut in momentum space. Yeah?
The Twister space picture is just two curves that intersect at some point WI.
No, the picture that I've drawn is in Twister space. The picture that I've drawn is, So the sequence of operation I've drawn would say you take this invariant, that invariant, you match the W's, and then you integrate them.
Right, but you draw the momentum space picture. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right. And you're right. I mean, hopefully a momentum space picture. Really, if you like, what this really means is there's a propagator identifying that W with that W on that side. But this is literally the integral. Okay? It's literally the integral that we just talked about.
But, I mean, I guess I'm pushing you. Can you draw the Twister space picture? Because it is nice. It's just two curves that meet at point WI.
Two curves. Oh, sure. That's right. That's right. Exactly. That's right. Now, the only reason why we decide to put these things together in a square is simply because this object is a perfectly fine object, but it vanishes for generic external momenta in momentum space, right? Just because it forces this delta of p squared forces the sum of all these external momenta to be on shell. So this is actually a nice factorization channel. Okay? It's a nice factorization. It just happens to vanish for typical external momenta. It's a perfectly fine object. Okay? But things that are non-vanishing for generic external momenta in momentum space are what you get by gluing four of these guys together. Because when you glue four of them together, now you have enough delta functions now you can completely solve for the internal momenta for completely generic external momenta, and that's the standard definition of a leading singularity. If you like, this could also be called a leading. These are all perfectly fine leading singularities. They're just not. They're just non-vanishing. They're just vanishing for typical generic external momenta. So there's nothing all that special from the point of view of Twister space or from the point of view of these Yang-Yang generators or anything from these pictures with the closed loops. It's just that these things are the things that map back to smooth objects in momentum space. Okay, so just as a simple consequence of the merge
and integrate out operations, we've shown that all leading singularities are Yangian invariant. That is a quite non-trivial statement to try to prove directly. In fact, what Jared and Lionel and Dave had done proved, just this formula proves that they're superconformal invariant, they're manifestly superconformal invariant, but they're not manifestly dual superconformal invariant. If you try to just prove directly that they're dual superconformal invariant, well, you have to have some argument. Okay, there are some combinatorics or some things you have to check. It doesn't just hit you in the face that it's obviously dual superconformal invariant. But this simple argument just proves that it's Yangian invariant directly. And since all Yangian invariants are computed as residues, since all Yangian invariants are contained as residues of the Grassmannian integral, therefore all leading singularities are contained as residues of the Grassmannian integral. There's actually a little bit more than that, which I think I won't have time to describe in detail, which is that not only is it guaranteed that they're Yangian invariant, you also know where they are. You know which residue they are. You know which residue they are because it's particularly straightforward to do these integrals in twister space. If you start with the Grassmannian formula, it's really straightforward to do these integrals. Because so this guy is some, I should make one other comment. The standard thing that's called leading singularities in field theory involves these objects and pictures like this being lower tree amplitudes. Okay? But that's not necessary at all. This is just a way of gluing together any old Yangian invariants, whether or not they have anything to do with the tree amplitudes. I could take some 17-loop leading singularity and glue it with some other object in a square, and it's some other Yangian invariant. It has nothing whatsoever to do with one-loop leading singularities. They're just operations for gluing, for gluing together invariants to build other invariants. But also, it's particularly straightforward to actually carry out these integrals and do them in twister space. The reason is that all of the dependence on the W's is in that delta 4 slash 4 factor, okay, in the Grassmannian integral. So you can just do the integrals over the W's very straightforwardly, explicitly. Okay? It's, in fact, particularly convenient, if you want to do that, to choose a gauge, to choose a gauge for doing the integral over this Grassmannian and that one, to choose a gauge where the location of WI is gauge fixed to be 10000 on this side, and similarly on that side, gauge fixed to be 10000. I can always do that. And then it's particularly straightforward because on the left hand side, I get WI is equal to some sum of the C's and the left W's from the delta function. I can integrate that on the delta function. I get WI is equal to that sum. I then insert it into the delta function that occurs over here. And so I have some new modified delta function that has a little bit of the C's from this side and the C's from that side. Okay? In this way, it's clear that you're just explicitly building a bigger K by N matrix, which just contains all the data of the lower K by N matrices in it. I just get some big delta function, which is a linear combination of all the z's, which is some shuffled around picture involving the k by n matrices on the left and the k by n matrices on the right. I explicitly build a big k by n matrix in that way. Huh? It's not quite block diagonal. It's had some things shifted over, some columns are shared, and so on. It's not exactly block diagonal. Okay? It's almost block diagonal, precisely. It's almost block diagonal. So I have one thing, and then the other one is just shifted over one, sharing a column, the other one shares a column. They share the columns corresponding to the guys that you got rid of. Okay? It's almost block diagonal. So that's a purely kinematic statement. Purely kinematic statement, you just integrate things out and you have this nice big K by N matrix. Okay? Well, so whatever you want, at that location in the Grassmannian, there's a residue. And the residue is Yangian invariant. So you know where it is. It's presented to you in a particular gauge, but you know the answer. You know where it is. Okay? Now, this argument, I should say, this argument is sort of purely kinematical. Okay? All of this would be true no matter what measure we use for the integral over the Grassmannian. Okay? If I had any old set of cyclic minors. Okay? So if I have any set of minors downstairs, when I integrate things out, it has nothing to do with the structure of the measure. It just has to do with the fact that there's a delta 4 slash 4. Okay? What's special about the cyclic minors? The thing which is special about the cyclic minors is this matrix that you get is guaranteed, A, to be a residue of the measure that you have, and B, the value of that residue is guaranteed to be related to the lower residues, the product of the lower residues in the appropriate way. Okay? That's very far from obvious directly. Very far from obvious directly, just playing with twister space. Okay? Just playing with these objects in twister space. That's a remarkable property of these cyclic minors. But that's something where if you're trying to prove it directly in directly in one space or the other seems hard, but we now see it indirectly as a consequence of putting together these basic operations that map Yang invariants to Yang invariants. Okay? So it's a little non-trivial mathematical fact, which is made obvious by this gradual way of doing it, by understanding this operation as a sequence of putting together many of the basic operations that map Yang invariants to Yang invariants. Okay. That piece is crucially dependent on this particular cyclic set of minors. Okay. And of course, that was a crucial bit of having all these things be Yang invariant to begin with. Okay. So let me finally tell you one last canonical operation, which is BCFW. What we call the BCFW bridge. Something that I've alluded to many times, but I have never actually written down, is the statement that the terms in the BCFW formula for the tree amplitude are particular cases of leading singularities. They're special leading singularities. This is how BC and F before W came up with the BCFW recursion relations. Okay? So they're the following kind of leading singularity. Remember, what we're doing when we do BCF is somehow we take a left amplitude, and we're gluing it, jamming it together with a right amplitude in a particular way. So that here is, let's say, particle n, here's particle 1, and we shift n, and we shift 1 in some way, and we take the product of them, we multiply by 1 over p squared, we get some nice object. So that's what it is at tree level. But the way it was arrived at was thought of in another way, thought of as a one-loop leading singularity, with these being three particle amplitudes. There's three particle amplitudes here, three particle amplitude there. Imagine you're looking at this one-loop leading singularity. So what you do is you're trying to put all four of these propagators on shell. Okay? And it's putting those propagators on shell, which even though this momentum coming in here is 1, there's some momentum flowing through their Q, and that deforms in here the 1 to 1 hat. So that means that there's a 1 hat flowing in there. And similarly here, this is getting deformed to an n hat, and there's an n hat flowing in there. So the BCFW term is a particular sort of leading singularity. As I mentioned, the motivation was that one-loop amplitudes are known to have universal infrared divergence properties. The leading double logarithmic divergence of one-loop amplitudes must be proportional to the tree amplitude. And BCNF realized that you could isolate the piece, which was double logarithmically divergent, in these diagrams and isolate the coefficients from these diagrams, and therefore the sum of these diagrams, their coefficients, these leading singularities have to be proportional to the tree amplitude, and that's how they could get a formula for the end particle tree amplitude in terms of gluing together lower point tree amplitude. Okay? But that, okay, if you haven't seen it, probably my explanation doesn't make any sense to you. But that's at least roughly why you could get recursion relations from looking at loop amplitudes. Tree-level recursion relations from looking at loop amplitudes. Anyway, but now we know that this is a picture. This is some particular leading singularity. So like every leading singularity, so I could draw it in twister space, for example. So I would draw it in twister space, again, like this, while merging these guys, integrating them out, merging, integrating them out. Left, right, and one. And we can even say that it doesn't even matter what left and right are. They don't even have to be tree amplitudes. Take random Yangian invariants. This is just a quite natural canonical way of taking two Yangian invariants, jamming them together to make a third Yangian invariant. Okay? So we can call this operation, whatever it is, YL jammed BCFW YR.
From the question with the only three legs, like minus one integral.
Sorry?
You haven't discussed this class.
This is a picture in twister space. So in twister spaces, these would be things involving k equals 1. K equals 1 is perfectly, m equals 1. M equals 1 is perfectly well defined in that twister space.
Yeah. So this is going to be the point. This is what it looks like in twister space. Now I'm going to show you what it looks like in momentum twister space. It doesn't look anything like that. Okay? It's going to be another way of combining our operations together in a natural way. Okay? But it doesn't look like that. I'm going to tell you what it does look like. All right. Sorry? No. I mean, no. I'm sorry. Here there's cuts, and here I'm just indicating that I've merged them and integrating them over. I know what you mean, but I know what I mean. So, and I'm giving the talk. No, actually, I would love to have. I mean, this is one thing. It's very unfortunate that we haven't had time. There's a whole very beautiful story about what's going on in just with BCFW and twister space, and anyway, there's lots and lots of beautiful things there. I think we're going to have to go back eventually and understand all of those things. But no, I don't. I'm not doing that just because I don't want to talk. I mean, yeah. Well, maybe Freddie should do it. No. Dave should do it. There you go. No. Actually, it's no. Anyway, you know why I'm not doing it. This is a bastardized picture that's meant to evoke the momentum space picture, but tell you what twister space computation to do. It's not what it looks like in twister space. What looks like in twister space is objects with certain localization properties intersecting on the corresponding internal lines, because that's what's going on in there. There's a propagator that's identifying these. In fact, it's the picture we drew. They're being identified in twister space. Okay? So we're just attaching them. We're gluing them to each other at special points in twister space. And then integrating over those points. Yeah. Well, we're doing it all the time, so it's yes. Okay, guys. There's exactly 6 people in the world who care about this. So and we're 4 of them. I apologize, Dave. I apologize. Okay. So, but this is clearly some Yangian invariant, so we should learn what it looks like in momentum twister space. All right. Now, let me tell you what the answer is. Let's just jump to the answer. I'm going to motivate what it looks like. We'll jump to the answer, then we'll go understand why it's true. Of course, I could sit here and just do it, right? I could just do it. I know what it looks like in momentum space. I can transform. I can I can laboriously derive all of it, but in point of fact, that's not how any of these things are done. You know you're looking for a Yangon invariant. You know it's invariant. You just look for the object that has the appropriate properties. You write it down, and then you back-check that it does exactly what it should do. Okay? Then, of course, you can derive it if you like. All right. So let's start by trying to guess what the answer is. Okay? An important clue to what the answer is in momentum twister space is the following. In twister space itself, when you take y left and y right, they have some m1 and some m2, and when you jam them together with BCFW, you're left with an object that has an overall m, which is m1 plus m2 minus 1. It's minus 1 because of that internal integral over that internal line. Okay? So, for example, if you start with 2 MHV, m equals 2, m equals 2, gives you m equals 3. When you jam them together, you get something with m equals 3. Now let's ask what has to happen in momentum twister space. In momentum twister space, the thing that had m equals 2 has k equals 0. It's an MHV object. Right? So we have k equals 0 and k equals 0. M equals 2, m equals 2, goes to k equals 0 and k equals 0. Now, the resulting object has m equals 3, so it has k equals 1. So there's something funny and different about this. Beforehand, I added up the m's and I subtracted 1. Now I have to add up the k's and add 1. Okay? Okay, so let's just say it again. In twister space, I started off with something which has m1 and m2. And the resulting object, when I jam these things together, has m1 plus m2 minus 1. It's minus 1 because of the integral of the internal d3/4w. Okay? Now, what is this what would this be in momentum twister space? In momentum twister space, the objects I'm talking about all have the k's or m minus 2. So in momentum twister space, I have to start with something that has k1, which is m1 minus 1. M1 minus 2. I have to have K2, which is M2 minus 2. And this has got to give me something whose overall K is K1 plus K2 plus 1. Okay? This is M1 plus M2 minus 1 minus 2 is M1 minus 2 plus M2 minus 2 plus 1. All right. So that's a little bit odd. So somehow in momentum twister space, momentum twister space, I need to start off with some object which has some k. With some k1, some k2. Say I have n here, I have 1 here, I have j here, I have j plus 1 here. Okay, so I start with something which has some K1 and some K2. Now, it's at least very intuitive that whatever this is should still involve an integral over the intermediate line. Okay? Because somehow we know this has got to be adjusting things to put the intermediate line on to make the intermediate line hit the factorization channel. So we should somehow have an integral here over. Well, so we should again be using a merge operation to merge this guy and that guy and integrate them over. Okay? So I have to have some zi that I got starting with two disjoint guys, identifying, merging them, integrating them over. So I have a d3/4 zi. I should expect something like that. But this just makes the problem worse because this removed the k removes another k by 1. Okay? So now, I somehow... So I have to start with something on here where the data is a residue. The data is a residue with its value k1. The data over here is a residue with value k2. I have to do something to it such that when I do the d3/4 integral, the resulting object is k1 plus k2 plus 1. And at the moment, it has k1 plus k2 minus 1, just like before, because I have this integral over this intermediate line. So what can I do? Well, the only thing I can do is I need to somehow increase the k on the left and on the right by 1. But how can I increase the k on the left and the right? I can do it by I need to give the data as the residue, right? Some particular Yangian invariant. So what I need to do is act on it with an inverse soft factor that increases k. Right? Now, where should I put this inverse soft factor? Okay. Now let me talk about where we should put the inverse soft factor. So let's go back. I've said this is VCFW, but I haven't told you what kind of deformation on the momentum twisters we're talking about. Okay. So VCFW deforms lambda n, lambda tilde 1. Okay? Those are the things that we deform, let's say. How is that to be interpreted here in terms of the momentum twister variables? The answer is the following. That it's Zn is being deformed like Zn plus the deformation parameter Zn minus 1. That's funny. This is affecting the deformation in ordinary momentum space that would deform 1 and n. Okay? But let's see why this is. This is actually very obvious if you just think about what the picture of the momenta are. So let's draw the picture in momentum twister space and then in X space, and then we'll see what's happening to the momenta. Huh? No. I'm not adding anything yet. For the moment, forget about this. Okay. I want to now talk about what's going to look like the BCF deformation. The BCF. This is the bridge. This is taking two things, jamming them together. But we got there in momentum space by taking the amplitude, deforming lambda 1. Lambda n and lambda tilde 1 and seeing what happened, its poles, and so on. I just want to back up for a second and just talk about what this deformation is. Okay? So if we deform n, if we deform zn like this, then here's the momentum twister zn minus 1. Here's the momentum twister zn that's wandering all over the place. Here's z1, z2, and so on. Okay? So let's see, who are we affecting? Which x's are we affecting? Now let's draw the picture in x space. Okay. I'm not affecting xn minus 1. I'm not affecting x2. I'm not affecting x3. I'm not affecting any of those x's. Okay. So those lines in momentum twister space correspond. So there's the point xn minus 1 isn't doing anything. The point x2 isn't doing anything. x3 isn't doing anything. x4 isn't doing anything. Okay. All that's going on, furthermore, actually, the line Zn minus 1, that line, is not being affected by the shift. This is just moving Zn along the line Zn minus 1. Okay? So actually, the line Zn minus 1 is also not changing under this shift. So that means that the point Xn is also not moving. Huh? What picture is very misleading? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it's completely misleading. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. So it's moving along that line. I drew it before I thought about where I wanted to put Zn minus 1. Okay, so Xn isn't moving either. The only thing which is moving is X1. So under this deformation, X1 is moving around, but the rest of the polygon is just completely fixed. And just X1 is moving around. So all that's doing is changing Pn and P1. Okay, it's exactly deforming Pn and P1, keeping everything null and momentum conserved. Okay? That's exactly what VCFW is doing. It's shifting two guys, keeping them null and momentum conserved. Okay? But it corresponds in this picture to shifting Zn by Zn minus 1. Okay. Let me just make one other comment while we're here. Remember, one of the issues in the BCFW shift was the behavior of the amplitude at infinity, right? The amplitude had to be nicely behaved at infinity. Of course, it's all beautiful. There at n equals 4, everything is fine, and so on. But let's just pause to think about what that looks like in this space, because there's a nice little bit of insight attached to it. Here, as little z goes to infinity, little z going to infinity here is not what we normally call in the BCFW deformation z goes to infinity. This z is not the same as the BCFW z. Okay? In fact, as little z goes to infinity, what happens? All that happens is that zn becomes projectively zn minus 1. These are all projective variables. Okay? So zn just becomes zn minus 1. It's a merge. Okay? It's, in fact, removing particle n. So there's actually a pole at infinity in z, in little z here. There is a pole at infinity. That's great. We know it's a residue. It's the one lower particle object. Okay? So everything is fine. But where then is this worried about pole at infinity that we talked about in momentum space? What is going to actual infinite momentum in this picture? You see, in the picture of the polygon, going to infinite momentum is this point going to the point at infinity. This is compact, conformally compactified. Okay? So there is a point at infinity, and going to infinity, the usual going to infinity that we talked about, corresponds to x going towards that point at infinity. Okay? So that means that in this picture, any pole there, any pole at infinity would involve something like Zn, Z1, and that infinity twister equals 0. Okay? So a potential, what we would normally call the pole at infinity in momentum space, would be in Z space at some funny finite location, if you could find something where Zn, Z1, I goes to 0 if there was a pole there. But you see, this is completely nuts. There can't be any such pole simply because of dual conformal invariance. So dual conformal invariance just makes it impossible for there to be any poles. Dual conformal invariance makes it impossible for there to be any poles at infinity in the standard sense. Okay? So that's kind of a nice connection. Okay? Of course, you could say, how do we know dual conformal invariance is true? Then you can trot back out to quantum field theory, give the argument that the amplitudes vanish at infinity, blah, blah, blah. But it's nice to see the connection. The pole at infinity is in one-to-one correspondence with just a breakdown of dual conformal invariants. Theories being dual conformal invariant, no standard poles at infinity. Okay? So that's a nice argument. Nice observation. All right. So let's go back and finish the story. So I'm deforming Zn goes to Zn plus Zn minus 1. And so clearly, what I need to see here is something. I'm integrating over the Zi, but I need to do something that's going to deform n. Okay? Because that's what's corresponding to the shift that we're talking about. So I'm going to add inverse soft factors, but I have to add them in such a way that they're going to deform n. So there's no choice. I have to add an inverse soft factor here. Okay? So I'm going to add a particle here. Let's say I add some particle n plus 1 here. Okay, that increases k by 1. Right? Now, I need to increase k on the other side as well. So I need to add some other crazy particle, n plus 2, here. You'll see in a second. Okay. You see, now I have to remove the. This was important because n has to be deformed. Whatever I'm doing has got to deform n, because we know that that I'm going to be end up evaluating m left, y left, and y right at a special value zn hat, where zn hat, I should have said this, where zn hat z1, zj, zj minus 1 is equal to 0. That's right. Exactly. That's right. I should have mentioned that. Exactly. In Twister space, you don't ever talk about a deformation. Nothing is deformed. And you see, that's exactly. Exactly. That's right. So now we have to see it. Right. Sorry? Huh? Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. But now I have to remove. Now there's this crappy data, n plus 1 and n plus 2. What the heck are those things? They're not part of the problem. Right? So how do I need to get rid of that artificial data. How can I do that? I merge. I merge n plus 1 with 1. And I merge n plus 2 with j plus 1. That's why you do it on this side, because you don't because you can't have double merges. On the other side. Okay. Yep. It modifies a lot of things, but this is the only thing that has a chance. Okay. Now it has all the right properties. I increase k by one side, on the other side, and all right. Okay, so this ends up being the right answer. Sorry?
Because I need n around, okay? I need and furthermore,
yeah, I should say this. You see, if you merge 1 with n, then you really haven't done anything, because you have because then I could have just done that operation just on the left beforehand. I would have just had a 1 lower tree amplitude. That's wrong. That's why I have to merge it on the other side for it to be non-trivial. Many things are deformed. I'll write down the final expression in a second. Okay, but in order to actually write down the final, in order to write down the expression, let me actually draw also what the geometry of this factorization channel is in momentum twister space. See, in momentum twister space. Okay.
No, it's literally
BCMW. In fact, this is literally the same Yangon invariant that we just talked about in twister space. This is what it is in momentum twister space. Okay. The way I'm describing it, you see, this. So if you want to think about this as being the residue of a pole deforming something under that deformation, then that Z is not the same as the BCFW Z. But the pole, the actual final invariant, is exactly the same object, just written in momentum twister space. Okay. Yeah. So let's go back to the picture that we know we need. Okay. We want to have a picture here. Somehow we know that left and right have got to be evaluated also with some internal points I here, and some n hat 1. Okay. N is being deformed, but it's got to be deformed in such a way that zn, z1, zj, zj plus 1 is equal to 0. Okay. Zn hat. So what is the picture? Here is let's draw it like this. Here is n minus 1 and n. and n hat is somewhere along this line. Okay, let's say n hat is here. So here's the geometry. Sorry, let me draw it on this board. Here's n minus 1 and n. N hat is deformed. Here's n hat and I and j plus 1. This is the condition that says that the sum of these momenta squared is equal to 0. So that's precisely the condition that we're sitting on the factorization channel denoted in this picture. Okay? So that's exactly the sum of all these p's squared is equal to 0. Xj plus 1 minus x1 squared equals 0. Okay? Sorry? N and 1. No, because we're computing these things on the factorization channel where the sum of where this guy is put on shell, just like in VCFW, right? You compute the residue at the location where you deform things, you deform these guys such that in the end, the sum of these guys squared is equal to 0. That's right. That's right. So this statement is the statement xj plus 1 minus x1 squared equals 0. And this, in turn, is nothing other than the sum of all these momenta squared is equal to 0. Okay, I'm sorry. I should have said that more explicitly. Okay. All right. And on the other side, we have something that looks like ij minus 1. one, two, and so on. Okay. This is what this factorization geometry looks like in momentum twister space. You see, I'm deforming n in the direction n minus 1 till I put n hat on the plane 1j, j plus 1. So that's exactly what's being accomplished here. Okay? This n hat is on the plane 1j, j, j plus 1. You can see that manifestly because n hat 1 intersects, that line n hat 1 intersects the line j, j plus 1. So n hat lies on the plane 1j plus 1j. Okay? Huh? No. So let's just talk about the geometry we're interested in at the end of the day. Okay? So the geometry we're interested in at the end of the day involves some deformed guy. Okay? And having done that, we're guaranteeing again that n1 intersects jj, n hat 1 intersects jj plus 1. That's precisely the factorization condition. The intersection point is zi. So clearly we're interested in evaluating y left and y right. Y left on this configuration, y right on that configuration. And the point i is simply zi. So n hat is where n minus 1 n intersects the plane 1j, j plus 1. And I should be where jj plus 1 intersects the plane, n minus 1, n1. Okay? That's right. So that's the momentum space geometry associated with this factorization channel. Okay? So whatever we do, we start with that picture. Okay, that picture, we have to be able to recognize all of these things, right? Now, so we have to do that integral over d3/4zi, okay? Actually, it's doing that integral over that d3/4zi is what we use that integral to locate I where we want, okay? So I has got to end up in the special place, but we have an integral, d3/4i, and we can identify poles on the left and on the right that allow us to precisely map zi to this point. Those poles come from the fact that, remember, when we act with the inverse soft factor, there's the overall R invariant that multiplies it. So on the left, there's an R invariant that multiplies it. On the right, there's an R invariant that multiplies it. And from the poles just in those R invariants, you can pick up three poles that exactly put I to that location very nicely. So you can canonically put I to that location. And then, now this is the point, the answer to your question. In that location, J is not deformed. Okay? With I in that location, J is not deformed. Okay? And everything stays put. So in fact, the final answer is, if you just do the computation, as I said, the final answer is that y left, y right, as a function of 1 up to n, is n minus 1, n 1, j, j plus 1, that R invariant, times y left of 1 up to j and I, times y right of I, j plus 1, n minus 1, n hat, where I is just what we said, is the supersymmetrically, this jj plus 1 intersect n minus 1, n 1, and n hat is n minus 1, n intersect jj plus 1, 1. That's right. That's what we saw. In momentum twister space, just deforming Zn is enough to deform two momenta in ordinary momentum space. Okay? Okay, so again, this is a quite lovely little formula. Again, if you're just handed this formula, it's not even remotely obviously superconformal invariant, but it's superconformal invariant, it's Yangian invariant, it's in fact exactly just the BCFW. It's just exactly BCFW written in momentum twister space. So this illustrates the point that I was making. That exactly the same quantity in twister space, and if we just draw it again, this is what it is in momentum twister space. And in twister space, it's a combination of the same basic operations drawn in the way that Dave loves more than anything else in the world. Okay. So they look very different in with an n and a 1. Extremely different. The combination of the same kinds of objects, the same sorts of operations. Well, we use the inverse soft factors on this one. We didn't on the other one. But we merged, we integrated out. They're Yangian invariant, but they look different in the two spaces. Okay? There are. That's right. There's two. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
If you get BCF from BCF as a leading singularity, or BCF, then there's never any deformation. And so, from that point of view, there's no deformation to stress either. On the other hand, if you get it from BCFW, then there's a deformation, and there's a deformation in twister space as well. And so they're completely equivalent, they're identical. You can view it in two ways, just as you can view it in two ways in the momentum space.
you're either actively deforming it or just evaluating the singularity.
So you really have none of those two amplitudes at the bottom and the shift, or you put those two amplitudes in at the bottom, and that does the shift. Same is true. It's presumably the same is true in momentum twister space. The problem is one of those is a 3.mhp, one of those is a 3.mhp bar, and the best you can say about the 3.mhp is that it's one in momentum twister space. And I don't know what the 3.mhp bar is identity in momentum twister space. It's somehow just a shift, it's an inverse quantum vacuum of a flat. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So it doesn't change the Young invariant, it just changes the relation between the momentum twisters and the lambdas and lambda tilts. The lambda tilts. But there's always these two ways. Well, whatever space you're in, there's always these two ways of viewing what this left of you is. Either a wind shift or as a higher using gravity.
The end result here is really extremely simple and canonical. You have these the invariant out in front. You just read off from the obvious guys. You see, it's so I should say that when we draw this, we sometimes draw a little arrow there to remind ourselves in momentum twister space we're deforming Zn. So it's the R invariant involving everyone who should be involved, n minus 1, n, 1, j, j plus 1. Okay? And then everything else is just multiplying the guys and just shifting them along lines until they lie on special planes. They're just all extremely simple geometric operations.
Because you shift one point x and that shifts two moment at the same time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. No. So
one or two deformations. There's never zero deformations.
Depending on how you think about it, in original twister space, there is or isn't a deformation. Okay. So,
saying that is in momentum space. Like in that diagram, which is a momentum space diagram for a universe.
Okay. If I think
no deformations.
If I think in terms of this diagram, there's no deformation, then no feature.
Oh, that's right.
Any feature that's never deformation.
Right, sorry.
If I think, in the other one, then there's either two deformations or one in this case. Because I need to deform two momenta always, and this is taken into account by either deforming two momenta or deforming one position of the polygon.
And in that picture, there's again one deformation.
One is the best I can do if I want to have that picture.
But it's really very close to a straight product with just simple shifts of the points along lines till they lie along the obviously privileged planes. Okay? And this actually makes it really incredibly fast. I mean, just to get results put on a computer, this makes it shockingly fast because
Because it's not even linear algebra, you're just basically cutting and pasting matrices that are black diagonal, relabeling stuff like this. I mean, doing BCFW from scratch all the way down to the bottom, the full recursion for like the 8-point square mhp is 20,000 times faster this, just simple computation, than putting in Drummond and Hens post-formula solution and evaluating it. Right? Things are much more efficient here. And you can also calculate these, and because of the inverse soft factors, because you can recursively know how to calculate residue based on lower cross lining and things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's extremely efficient to actually evaluate something.
Yeah, so this is what allows, 30-point tree data with zero problem. I mean, they're just there. And as you'll see, having access to high-point tree amplitudes is going to be very useful for us if we can do 2, 3, 4, 5 loop integrands for superimpulse. It'll all come just from that.
One more set of simple operations we have to talk about tomorrow is all it takes to start getting all the loops out. All right.
Looking at the Grassmann thing on.
You could. That's right. You in fact. So you could. As I said. You could go back to the momentum twister form of the Grassmann integral and see what this factorization channel looks like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very special form of the D matrix that's associated with these residues. That's a very beautiful form. But I have to say that you're right. In principle, no difficulty. Okay? You can just do it. In principle, you know the momentum space formula. You can just translate it. You can just do it.
and you get this answer. So it's but this is somehow a much more transparent way of thinking about it, because it makes it obvious why it's Yang invariant. Okay, it makes it obvious why it's Yang invariant, and shows that it's a consequence of these same basic operations. Okay? And it shows the utility of this merge picture. Well, it shows the utility of all of them, but we're going to see. Well, it shows the utility of all of them. We're going to see them all in action over and over again. Okay? So it's good to get used. It's good to see that it's also a useful idea elsewhere. Okay? Just to since this was all sort of relatively technical and just setting up some tools, just whet your appetite for tomorrow. The claim is that if you start with some lower point object, and you remove two particles, so you just eliminate them, okay? Then you would just get some other Yang invariant. But since this now involves a D3/4ZA, D3/4ZB,
if this guy's A and B, there's another natural contour of integration that you can choose to do in removing these particles that makes it look explicitly like a loop integral. So we denote that with a little wiggly line here, saying that we're choosing an entangled contour for removing these two particles. And the entire the place where all loops come from is that basic operation. You remove two particles, and then you merge the guys that surrounded them. Okay? That's the seed for all loop amplitudes in this theory. So it takes both of these operations. Remove these particles in this interesting entangled way, and then hide what you did by merging the guys around them. Okay? This ends up computing the so-called single cuts that will be needed to compute some inhomogeneous term in BCFW recursion for loop-level integrands. Okay? So we'll come back to that tomorrow, but this is the basic thing that's going to use both of these operations. We added a particle with an inverse soft factor. Sorry, I should have said we add a particle with an inverse soft factor, remove the two adjacent guys, and then merge it with the one that's left over. Since I got rid of these guys, I can now merge it across them. If you do that with ordinary contours of integration on this guy, nothing, everything is fine. You just get a boring tree amplitude back. But if you do it on this entangled contour of integration, you get loops. Okay, thank you.